He's an active participant with the Millennium Project for Global Future Studies and Research of the American Council for the United Nations University. Whew. Charles has 25-plus years' experience in the field of electronics, materials sciences, computing, artificial intelligence. That'll be the focus tonight. I love that subject, actually, including 8 years at Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory at the University of California, Berkeley, and Los Alamos National Lab, so he should know what he's talking about. Nanotechnology coming right up. Charles Ostman, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so very much. Good to be back in the air. I'm glad that you're on the air.
When was the last time that you and I spoke?
Oh, I was digging through my archives. I think it was April of, or possibly May of last year.
Long time ago.
Yeah, something like that.
All right. A lot in your field, actually, that's a lot of time.
That's
isn't
a
it?
Lot of time. You're 100% correct.
Your field is going berserk. I see a lot of stock market money and investment beginning to go into nanotechnology and that sort of thing.
Big money.
Yeah, but tonight, I guess the focus is going to be on artificial intelligence, and boy, do I have a lot of questions about that. First of all, Charles, does it exist yet?
Well, not to be Clinton-esque, but define intelligence. I'm not being cute, but let me explain that. If you go backwards in time to, say, Marvin Minsky and that sort of thing, the early days of artificial intelligence, the plan at that time was to simply mimic what looks like intelligence. That is, you would write code and create a computer program that could sort of quasi-simulate the way a conversation works. You had a sort of random effect to it. You had a sort of cognition effect to it. But it wasn't smart.
No, not at all.
It was just a machine.
Yeah, not at all.
Okay, now let's fast forward to the intersection of nanotechnology and AI. And by the way, Charles Schultz, Sir Charles Schultz, great, very good guy. I've actually heard him speak a number of times. I hope you ask him about his Mars stuff, because that's actually his most interesting thing.
But ask him what?
About his Mars work.
Well, I've done hours with him on his Mars work.
Okay, forgive me, but I think, this, and as a segue to what I would talk about later, by the way, think about this. Sometimes people in big organizations see the truth but can't really say what they see because they're confined to a kind of a specific box. I would say that NASA knows a lot more about the life that they've, or the evidence for life that they found on Mars and what they're saying publicly.
Yeah.
And he's done a pretty good job of trying to show what NASA can't say.
Is it you think NASA can't or won't say?
I'll tell you. I happen to have a handful of friends here in Northern California. They actually work at the astrobiology group with NASA at Moffett Field. It's about maybe half an hour's drive from here.
Yes.
And, oh, heavens, I've talked to these folks a number of times. Jonathan Turner, I've known for quite some time. Actually spoken.
Okay, and the answer to the question
okay,
is?
Okay, so here we go. When I was in Southern California at a conference, met the president of JPL. We were there having a chat with some friends of mine. One of the guys I was with, he's very religious, very well-educated. He's an economic advisor, but actually talks to the president sometimes.
Yes.
So we're at the table, and I happened to say to the president of JPL, I said, hey, you know, I've been looking at some photographs of fossils on Mars. I didn't mention Schultz's name. I said, I've seen a lot of other evidence, and I've, you know, what do you think about this? How do you think, how close are we to being able to say publicly that we've actually found some kind of ancient life on Mars?
Yes.
And before the guy could even get, you know, two words out of his mouth, this friend of mine, who's, you know, very distinguished, very gentlemanly, almost yells, says, you won't find life on Mars. And he starts, you know, I mean, ranting, and I thought, wow, what have I done? Good heavens. Well, he's very religious. He's a good guy, but very devoutly Christian. And in the lexicon of his world, there cannot be life in another world.
All right. Well, here's the deal, Charles.
Yeah, yeah.
My audience, for the most part, I think pretty well buys that there is obviously life on Mars.
Or at least
we've been lectured on it. So the audience here pretty well buys it, but not everybody else.
Not everybody else. And so I use that as a kind of a metaphor for one of the topics that I was hoping we'd talk about tonight, which was peak oil. Not to get away from artificial intelligence, but there's a similar kind of mindset, not religious, but a similar kind of, this is the box we know about. We do not want to see another box. This is our box. We're going to cling to it. And that's kind of why I wrote the letter I did to your
All right, so peak oil.
Okay, so peak oil.
Is the whole concept of peak oil real or bogus?
It's both. But let me explain, please, please. Okay, there is a credible argument to say that we have been, you know, running out of oil, sort of. But there is also a credible argument to say that the chemistry of oil is not what we once thought it was. And therefore, could there be, excuse me, a different kind of metric for measuring how much oil there really is? And if you want to take that second path, and being a material science guy, I like this kind of stuff, so I look into it, it may well be that petroleum or the long-chain hydrocarbons that petroleum is made from may be not dinosaur juice at all. And a lot of not dinosaur juice at all, as us folks call it. A lot of folks used to joke about the fact that petroleum was the remnants of decayed dinosaurs and plants.
Yes.
And so on. The point being, though, that, well, a couple of things, quickly. If you drill down 5,000 feet, 7,000 feet, 10,000 feet, even up to 15,000 feet, there have been some drills that deep, and you're still finding oil, I defy any geologist or somebody who specializes in that particular kind of geology to show me the model of how organic material gets that far down, and you still keep finding more of the stuff.
Yeah, I don't know, but I do know this. We are going to run out of cheap oil, and that's all relative stuff, but we are obviously, if you look at the prices, we are running out of cheap oil. It's going to go nowhere but up, and when it gets high enough, it really won't matter whether there's a whole lot of it 10 miles down. We're going to be in big economic trouble.
Oh, I thoroughly agree. I am not in any way suggesting that we should ignore the reality of that. Even if the oil is there in some huge number we can't even fathom, if it costs so much to get to it, or it takes such complicated geopolitical enterprises to get to where the oil could be, you know, et cetera, clearly we have to have a variety of options to work with. And that's kind of why I find this whole realm so peculiar, because if you start reading the fine print about who publishes what numbers, about how much oil there is, could be, should be, or was claimed to be at some past point, you find that very little of this has to do with the actual amount of oil found or even what the geologists think there really is. And it has an awful lot more to do with, especially in a number of nation states, Middle East and so on, their vision of oil reserves and so forth is much more tied to the projected value or power of their economy, their creditworthiness on a kind of a global economic interface. And for many other countries, it's the sort of epitome of their sort of political presence in the world, mm-hmm. marketplace, et cetera.
Yes, well, if we're running out of cheap oil, is something going to come along and save us in the realm of nanotechnology?
Thank you for the question.
All right, then please, the answer.
By all means. And first of all, let me preface by saying that probably one of the greatest minds we've had in this era, who really was the pioneer of much of what I'm going to talk about in a few minutes, it just passed away. His name is Richard Smalley, professor of chemistry emeritus at Rice University, and really the most, won the Nobel Prize in chemistry, I should point out.
Uh-huh.
And just passed away a few months ago, and I actually even shared the stage with him once, not too long ago in Washington, D.C. The point being that he was the best voice. He said, look, all fluff and frills aside, here's some practical answers. We can do this, but it's going to take, 5 years for this and 7 years for that. But we have the tools to get to this point. And Washington was kind of listening to him. In fact, they were listening to him a lot. So, sadly, he's gone. So, in his place, I'm going to try to replicate a lot of what he was talking about.
All right, please, if you can go directly to it.
Okay, sure.
Please.
I think the most important thing we can start with is hydrogen. And why does nanotech play a role in hydrogen? Here's why. To store hydrogen for the user, that is you or me driving a car, right now you can't. I mean, you could have a pressurized tank and, 30,000 PSI and so forth, but if you were to crash or have a bit of an accident, the results of that tank suddenly exploding or rupturing would be very unpleasant for everybody, including yourself. By contrast, if we could store the hydrogen in solid-state medium, that's where all of a sudden hydrogen becomes very practical and very doable.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the cost of the fuel cells and all that kind of thing. It's really how do you get the hydrogen to the car. So there have been some materials called metal hydrides. Some of your guests actually talked about this some time ago, Bob Lazar being one of them. But the problem with metal hydrides is they tend to be kind of expensive and they're a difficult material to work with. But they do store the hydrogen as a solid-state medium. Now forward comes nanotechnology and carbon nanotubes. These tubes are beautiful because they have an extraordinary capacity for packing order. That is, you can fill them up with all kinds of other atoms if you wish. It just so happens that hydrogen fits in very, very well in a sort of a cage of carbon, as it were. Other metallic dopants are added to the carbon to kind of add to the process. But the basic point is, a number of people have been experimenting with this. In fact, a company right here, not even 10 miles from where I live, called Nanomics, was doing this up until a couple of years ago. I think that with, say, another 3 to 5 years to refine the process down to the point where it could be an inexpensive commercial device of sorts, you would have a hydrogen tank in your car that instead of having to store pressurized gas, you'll be storing molecular hydrogen attached to these carbon nanotubes that can be pulled out with a small amount of heat.
All right. The arguments against hydrogen have been that it takes fossil fuel or something like it to...
No, contrary, my friend. And I do know that in Nevada, of course, as I'm sure you have seen, they have the methane gas and the natural gas hydrogen capture system and so on. Now, there's an argument to say that in that context, it is true. And in fact, I talked to a guy just a few days ago at the conference I was at who was part of this whole program. And their objective was not so much to make hydrogen as the ultimate, the extraction process they're using as their ultimate answer. Actually, what they were doing, they were immersed in the infrastructure. They were developing filling station systems and delivery systems and so forth. They were simply getting the hydrogen from the natural gas resources, not because that's the way they want to get hydrogen, because they wanted to be able to have the hydrogen to build up these other...
All right, so is all of this economically feasible on a giant scale?
I think the most promising thing is going to be biohydrogen.
Biohydrogen.
Yeah, let me explain that. Craig Venter, who you may have heard of, he founded the company Solera. He's the one who ran the private version of the Human Genome Project. Very, very bright guy. I've had the pleasure of talking to him a couple of times. This is a guy who's really down to spreadsheets and brass tacks mixed with science. No fooling around for this guy. But what he's doing right now, he's actually out at sea on a boat with a crew, and they're investigating these deep-sea, deep-trench microbes that live on a chemical as opposed to a sunlight-based ecosystem. The significance of that is that these microbes generate huge amounts of methane. I mean, extraordinary in terms of the volume-to-mass ratio and that sort of thing. There's no other organism even close.
I understand there is a very great deal of methane at the bottom of our oceans.
There certainly is, and there's a lot to be said for this. But allow me to just tap into this. If we can take these microbes and genetically modify them a little bit, that's what Craig Venter is so good at, the theory is we could eventually build what looks like breweries, you know, like you brew beer. Only instead of brewing beer, you're in a sense brewing methane gas, but enormous amounts of it. And these would be in big tanks, just like in a brewery. Doesn't require a lot of energy because methane, you have 4 hydrogens for every carbon. It's very easy to take the hydrogen off. If that was the way you're doing it, you're growing a biomass material from which you could then harvest the hydrogen on a contiguous basis, and the amount of resources required to run that kind of system are very, very small. It's not even close to, I mean, yes, you're right. If you're going to take natural gas and try to strip out the hydrogen, that's a loss leader. Nobody's planning on doing that for a permanent solution.
So it's just a stopgap measure.
It's a stopgap measure so they could experiment really with how
okay,
to...
Okay, but then Charles, if that's all it is stopgap, then it's not worth converting everything now, is it?
It's worth starting the process. And this is the very message that Richard Smalley and many others...
Well, not unless what you're going to bring on is backwards compatible.
Well, let me try this one. For instance, a car can actually burn hydrogen directly in the engine. You can take any combustion engine and with a few hundred dollars worth of parts, basically run on hydrogen.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the British were doing this.
Well, I guess that's what I'm asking. Whether it's automobiles, a big factor, or whatever else is powered, whatever you eventually come up with would have to be backwards compatible if you're going to build any kind of infrastructure around it.
I think that over time, I'd be looking at something like a 10 to 12-year program, maybe with some tax credits or other incentives that could be added so it's, you know, reasonable for the average person. But yes, you could take the average car. I'm not sure about diesel, but certainly a gasoline-powered car. And you can sort of change carburetors or have a dual carburetor configuration. You flip a switch and it goes from hydro to gas, that sort of thing. Excuse me, a lot of folks have been experimenting with this. I mean, the point is there's a lot going on that the general public doesn't really see. I'm not saying there's conspiracy. I'm just saying it's not typical daily news. And yet the actual amount of effort gone to this exact direction, that is, How do we transition to hydrogen? Can we have both fuels at once? Are we ever going to fully replace petroleum with hydrogen? No, of course not. But I think what we want to be doing is having a mixture of options available so that we are no longer tied to this very narrow umbilical cord of oil that mostly comes out of parts of the world we probably shouldn't have anything to do with.
Mm.
That's what, you know, I'm looking towards a more balanced approach to how we manage our energy problems. Now, if you talk to people from, say, Chevron Oil, who I have, you know, they have a very different world than mine. They don't even want to hear about hydrogen. They want to hear about oil shale. And,
right,
you know, they have
sure.
their claws sort of ready to go diving into the Rocky Mountains. And,
well, if that's the case, though, Charles,
yes,
that means that, let's put it this way, at the very highest levels, that's basically the plan.
And this is why I wanted to go on the air, because I want people to at least think about, I'm not saying I'm a paragon of wisdom here, I'm just saying think about the range of choices we have. So here's a choice, but maybe not the best choice. Yes, we could go for the oil shale. Back 25 years ago when I was at Lawrence Laboratory here in Berkeley, we were looking at this exact same problem.
Yeah.
But what is the problem with oil shale?
It's expensive, for starters.
Ah, but something even more serious. Here's how you create oil from oil shale. And let me make sure I get this clear. It's not the same as, say, tar sands. Tar sands is a very different situation. In tar sands, like the stuff they found up in Canada, we have a gigantic, you know, vat of sand, I mean, on a huge scale. You simply dig up the sand, you run it through a chemical slurry, heat it up, and eventually cook the oil out of it. Okay, that's fine. No problem with that. But the oil shale is an entirely different matter. And the process that they were experimenting with, and the one that they seem to be most focused on, it's called a retort. It's a chemical expression. But what it means is you carve a section out of a mountain. You literally drill into it, both horizontally and vertically.
Right.
And you place charges. And these charges have to be very, very precisely timed. We're talking a few microseconds from each charge, which anyone who works in mining can tell you that's really, really pushing the envelope. But okay, so you have this gigantic, you know, a quarter of a cubic mile of space that you've drilled out vertically and horizontally. You set off this pretty complicated pattern of charges. The theory is that if the temperature and the shock waves and the pressure differentials created are just right, and I mean really a narrow envelope, if they're just right, yes, you will instantaneously pulverize that shale, which is a fairly soft material. It'll get cooked very quickly, and something resembling oil will sort of come out the other end.
How much?
Well, this is why it's not a good idea.
It's all a theory.
It's all in theory. We've done some very small-scale, underline the word small-scale,
okay,
you know, lab experiments.
Right.
You try to expand this up to a mountain or a range of mountains, here's what you get, because we did try some field studies. You get partial retorts. You carve out this giant chunk of a mountain, blow the thing up with all these charges, and, yeah, some oil comes out. But what's left behind is really unpleasant. We're talking a highly concentrated mush.
All right. It sounds like we're talking highly concentrated, not worth talking about technology to me.
Well, the thing is, you'll get oil, you know, you'll get lots of oil.
Yeah, I hear
but
that.
But the stuff you left behind is very, I mean, this is like a toxic waste dump on a scale that nobody can even imagine. In shale, which
is
very
poor. Oh, I can imagine. I mean, look what we're putting up at Yucca here.
Well, yeah, so. Thank you so much. I mean, and right in your own neck of the woods, you clearly have sort of a version of this. But the point is, the stuff left behind drips into the Oxalaca water aquifer and basically all the other water aquifers that, you know, get their drainage from those mountains.
All right, so let us not spend a lot of time talking about something that isn't going to work.
The only reason I'm talking about it is because you have to understand the politics and the policy and the culture of all these different conflicting entities, which have very specific but very... You know,
all right,
important.
To be clear,
yes.
Charles, are you saying then that this is the path they've decided to go down?
Thank you so much.
Is that accurate at the highest
path,
levels?
I talked to their top guy. He's their top PhD spokesperson, MIT graduate of physics, etc., guy named Dan Paul, you know, very smart guy, very polished, very smooth.
Yes.
And this is his party line. He's like, this is Chevron, this is what we're going to do, and, you know, we're going to go do it. And behind the scenes, I mean, they've paid all kinds of money, and they've got all the leasing rights.
Yeah, all right, hold on, Charles. Hold on. He just absolutely runs right over and throws his whole head under the water. He gets soaking wet. That is so utterly, I don't know, uncat-like. And I always laugh, and I say, you little idiot. But he'll do it. You turn on the water, and he will. It's like for other cats, you know, the sound of a can of cat food opening up is, well, they can hear that from a mile away. For this little guy, the sound of tap water beginning to run has exactly the same effect. Well, all right, Charles, there are, you know, I get computer messages while we're on the air here.
Oh, I totally get that.
A couple of pretty harsh ones here.
Oh,
but
let's go for it.
I want you to deal with them if you can.
That's okay.
All right, Steve from Mount Holly Springs, Pennsylvania says, sorry, Art, but I think tonight's guest is a moron. That was uncalled for, certainly. His analogy about oil not possibly originating from dinosaurs and plant matter because of the depths it's being found at is asinine. Mr. Know-It-All clearly doesn't, and he and his childish noises are annoying. Now, this is followed up by Matt in Santa Rosa, who says, Art, this guy's another guy selling happy, feel-good visions. The fact is, we're blanked, and it's going to be every man, every woman for himself, solar cells, seeds, silver rounds, shotguns. They're the future, not some guy's experimental biohydrogen scheme. So, you know, they're not accepting this well, it would seem.
Oh, my heavens. Well, you know, that latter call, I'm so sorry, because there are some people, and I sort of get this. Look, I can relate to this.
Stay close to the phone.
Okay,
you're
sure.
Drifting away there.
If they can't grasp or see the larger picture of what's going on, then it's very easy to get a rather fatalistic view and say, well, you know, we're toasted at some certain point.
Well, based on the first half hour you just delivered to me, I'm sorry, I've got to be in the toast group. I mean, you talked about some technologies that just, you know, aren't going to work. You're telling me the big companies are sold on shale oil as a follow-up to, you know, when the oil gets too expensive or rare or whatever is going to happen.
Well,
and then you virtually told me it won't work.
That's a quasi-political and very complicated economic sort of a choice. But let me try to address the first question, because I really, when people get that frothing with rage, it's the perfect segue to kind of go into a larger view so that maybe a better, more balanced approach can be taken.
All right.
I wasn't just harping on the idea that there's some debate about whether petroleum comes from a biological source or not. Believe me, there is a debate going on, and let me tell you why that debate is happening as we speak. Not too long ago, we started discovering methane coming from all sorts of places, not just the surface of Mars, but
right.
Even comets.
Right.
And you're thinking, well, wait a second, hold the fort here. We were taught since our earliest days of high school chemistry that any hydrocarbon, even something as simple as methane, has to come from biological sources. That was just the way it was taught. Well, not so fast. You know, you have to understand, you get to a certain critical mass threshold where it's drummed into people's heads, this is how it is. This is the science. No debate. This is how it's going to be. This is the policy, you know, et cetera. Science is replete with myriad examples where what we thought was the absolute, unarguable, you know, this is a chisel in stone for all eternity
yes.
answer.
Yes.
Second, third, fourth look, it wasn't quite how we thought it to be.
Uh-huh.
This is another example. In fact, the original sort of chemistry debate came out of Russia well over a century ago. There was kind of a tussle between these two famous Russian scientists. One was talking about that it was a biologically derived source. The other was saying, no, it's more of a geological source. And kind of for political reasons, actually, the sort of bio guy won out. And it became dogma. It became, you know, the law of God, as it were.
Yeah, but, you know, Charles, oil wells are beginning to dry up. I mean, that's happening.
There are
a few strange people out there who say, oh, no, look, they're refilling. But, you know, actually, they don't seem to be, Charles.
They don't fill up at the rate. And this is where it gets very complicated. By the way, a very good book and a very smart guy to listen to, if you don't like me, I'll go listen to this fellow. His name is Matthew Simmons. I've talked to him a number of times. He's probably one of the top energy analysts.
And what does he say?
Well, he's written a book called Twilight in the Desert, I believe, and he goes into extreme detail. I mean, you can't get a more fact-packed book about this is what this peak oil thing looks like, this is where it is, this is why it's coming, you know, et cetera. Now, I may not agree with his conclusions exactly, but I do agree with the numbers, and I do agree with his general assessments of the complexity of how these numbers are produced and all the politics and everything surrounding them. And I'll agree to this point. Yes, there may or may not be an argument. I'm on the fence, really, about where the oil really comes from. Some people theorize it comes from down the mantle. It's cooked up as a geological process.
Yeah, but Charles, if we're running out of it, what difference does it make?
That's where I wanted to go. Thank you so much.
Well, good.
Because even if the abiotic oil theory works, the rate at which it percolates up into the upper crust where we can get to it is much slower
than
the rate we're sucking it out of the crust. So it doesn't really matter. You're right. That's where I was wanting to go.
All right. Then let's move from it doesn't really matter to what we're going to do when we do run out of cheap oil, relatively cheap.
What we have to do, and to address your second caller or the computer person's voice, we have to start now. We're not going to have it all at once. We're not going to just flip a giant switch and go, okay, we're all doing hydrogen. We're going to have to look at a composite, a sort of a puzzle, really, or a quilt. It may be ethanol in some cases, it may be hydrogen in some cases, it may be traditional oil in some cases, and it may be other sources. Another area to look at, by the way, the last time you had me on the air, I was talking about batteries, and you kind of, when I said nano and batteries, you immediately went to like tiny batteries in a watch, and I said, well, no, that's not where I was going. I'm going to batteries in cars and in trucks.
Right.
Now, why do I say this? Here's the reason. Because if you look at traditional lead-acid batteries, which have been around for well over a century, you know, they work, but are they really practical to make an electric vehicle really, you know, function in today's world? No.
No.
They'll never get there. However, if you were to go to a nanomaterial solution, now all of a sudden you can create a battery that's made of a solid-state material. And I won't go into all the chemistry, but trust me, there's a lot of folks actually working this as we speak. Now all of a sudden you can have many times more power in the same physical size and much less weight, by the way.
Well, I understand. We have already actually made great advances in storage.
Absolutely.
Right? We have some pretty good batteries. Actually.
And there's a lot better ones coming around the corner.
I believe that, yes. But that's a storage facility for energy. The question is where it comes from.
Well, thank you so much. So now we fast forward to, okay, so you can have the option of a petrol-based fuel system and or a hydrogen fuel source or an electrical source, depending upon where you are and what kind of energy combination makes sense for you in a given specific region.
Do you think that our current infrastructure, meaning gazillions of gas stations scattered about the U.S., could deliver this sort of a gaggle of different fuels that you're talking about?
I think that's where we want to be going as an interim measure. And I think that, believe me, I've seen right there in your state of Nevada, I've seen it physically, sort of like a hydrogen fuel system. It looks just like a gas pump, only it has a certain kind of hose and a nozzle, et cetera, that's adapted for delivering hydrogen. I see no reason, and if you talk to other folks like British Petroleum, they have a very different view, by the way, than Chevron, as an example. They are actually doing this. That's what they want to do. That's their plan. They visualize a scenario where you'll drive up to your BP station, wherever they are, and you'll have, just like they have now, they have three grades of gasoline and diesel. Well, you'll find your gasoline, diesel, and a hydrogen hose.
Let's leave oil for a moment. The focus tonight really was supposed to be AI.
I'm interested in
AI. So if you would, please, we just sort of touched on it. You said, well, you know, there were these programs that were sort of pseudo-AI, but obviously they're not. And so my question to you is, how close are we getting to that moment when we actually have artificial intelligence? I guess that means, does that mean awareness of self?
That means artificial life, not artificial intelligence.
Okay,
and
thank
we are
you.
We're getting very close.
Oh, that's fascinating.
It is fascinating.
How close?
Well, oh my gosh, what an interesting area to dive into.
Please.
Probably the most prolific example of things that look like life because they actually are autonomous, they will find their own strategy, they will develop their own response to stimuli that we don't even predict what they are, but they do it, and this is being done. There's an arena of computing called evolutionary computing, and I have no doubt Dr. Schultz will dive into this as well. But evolutionary computing was kind of the progenitor of this whole genre of what's called artificial life, which is becoming a very big deal. I mean, if you're involved in computer science and whatever, and you just do a web search, or you go to some of the major conferences, you'd be astonished. Kind of like nanotech, the pace at which this is clipping along is moving very fast. And what evolutionary computing means is that you create a system that uses something like an evolutionary process to determine its own best path for solving complex problems. And we do this now, actually. Your banks use it for risk analysis, for very complex economic forecasting.
Mm-hmm.
It's used by insurance companies. It's used, actually, but the biotech industry is by far the biggest user of evolutionary computing because they're trying to mimic unbelievably complex models of physiological systems, which no ordinary computer could possibly hope to get to. So they create an evolutionary paradigm to, in a sense, allow the computer to evolve its own best response.
Mm-hmm.
To
Charles, is this work on AI proceeding publicly for the most part, or do you think that the real AI work is behind very closed doors?
It's behind very closed doors. But let me tell you why. I'll give you a little example. Not to plug my own thing, but you know, twice a year I share this little conference. It's a nanoelectronics photonics group. It's gathering about 100 or so people. But what we do is we bring in some of the best and the brightest of the real cutting-edge people who do the way out there stuff, as it were, amongst which artificial life is my favorite topic. So I always include a couple of those guys in my conference. Well, about a year ago, I had a guy from New Mexico, a company called Gnome Tech, and he had something very interesting. He was doing a kind of a quasi-biocomputing sort of platform where he was using a nanotechnology approach, and I won't say the chemistry, to create an evolutionary computing platform, but based on chemistry as opposed to electronics.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting stuff. I mean, it was a pretty good shot.
Okay, well, that's getting pretty close to creating life.
Well, you're getting very close to the actual target. Now, the people who fetched him up and started paying his bills, DARPA, as you can well imagine.
DARPA, yes.
And their first target was to make smart vehicles much smarter. And where they want to go with this, by the way, is autonomous hunter-killer units that can drive around or fly around and seek out targets of opportunity and dispatch them, that kind of thing. You know, the ultimate smart cruise missile or smart tank, that kind of thing.
Yes, it features, that would be the first application, something that would just fly and kill and kill and kill and kill.
Well, you know, Art,
Make its own little decisions. There's one.
I know this sounds very bad in a certain way, but there's a flip side to this coin. And believe me, I'm actually a very peaceful guy. I don't necessarily like building things that kill people. But there is a narrow slit of logic that says if you're going to send people into harm's way, like we're doing in Iraq, I'm sorry to say, maybe there are times when you don't want to necessarily have to send the people in to do certain kinds of military tasks.
Right.
And if we can get to that point where we can minimize the impact on human life, both ours and our adversaries, whoever it may be, and get to some diplomatic solution, you know, I mean, there's a certain way to look at this, and I say this with extreme care, because I know that...
Well, diplomacy works much better when you have a hydrogen bomb.
I know, and the last time I was on the air, you at the very close of the show, you said, hey, Charles, what's the most exotic thing you've seen so far? And I said, well, there is some work being done on an antimatter bomb, and an antimatter bomb can make a hydrogen bomb look tiny by comparison. So, I mean, yes, there are the kind of absurd answers, but I'm saying practically, in a realistic way, in a field of battle, and you have a certain amount of resources, and you want to try to minimize the impact on your human resources, and you also want to minimize the collateral damage, because that's not really what war is about. War is about trying to solve a problem that couldn't be solved any other way. There could be a case for having smart machines, but not to get into that too much. What I was just trying to get to is that the pathway for developing self-evolving, autonomous, neural network-like systems that really are like a living system. I mean, as close as you can possibly imagine.
One quick question. How do you know they evolve in a fashion that you want them to? How do you control that?
Well, that could be a very delicate question. But let me toss an answer to you, which might be sort of interesting. I, as mentioned JPL earlier, I go there a couple times a year for various things. About 3 or 4 years ago, I was there for the Evolutionary Hardware Conference. There is such a thing. And there's an entire engineering realm out there that says, we are tackling incredibly complicated problems, so why not evolve a solution as opposed to, you know, design it? That's what's being done. So at JPL, they were looking at a particularly challenging antenna design. It had to be a very small antenna with this very wide spectral range and certain notches, and you know, you're a radio guy, you can kind of appreciate this.
Yes.
Antenna design is kind of a black art. I mean, it's a combination of physics and electrical engineering and, you know, some voodoo that has to be converted into mathematics to get the thing to work perfectly. So they had this really difficult problem. They said, okay, I'll tell you what, we're going to bring some evolutionary computing guys, and we'll park them over here on one corner, call them the EC, if you will, and we're going to have our design team, our top-notch guys, they're going to do their version. Okay, about a month or so later, the humans had their version, a very beautiful little Christmas tree type thing with perfect little orthogonal branches. Look very nice, looking like a professional antenna.
Design. Okay, the show is going to be over soon.
Okay,
we only have an hour. So
The EC evolved what looks like a bird nest. It was like a ball of twine. The interesting part was it worked better than the human version, and more importantly, nobody could explain why. And so I make that point because this is a metaphor for a much larger arena where you have these artificial lifelike systems who evolve their own answers, and we may not even understand what the answer, what the pathway for the answer was.
Okay, well, again, my delicate question.
Yes.
If you would.
Yes.
The answer to it.
We.
In other words, how do we be sure that the evolution of this life that we have created is going in a direction that would be satisfactory for the human race?
Because the one handle we have is we can hardwire the end result. In other words, if we can say, look, here's a problem, go solve this, we can nail down very specifically, this is the result we want. Now, the EC may come up with a very unusual strategy to get there, granted, but at least we know what the result is supposed to be.
So then there would be no chance that we would task this new life we've created with, for example, solving the temperature problems, the climate problems we have right now, and that the machine would make a decision that, yes, it can be handled. Here, let me take over some of the weapons systems, and let's thin the world's population. That will, in fact, solve it.
Yeah, well, I know what you're getting at, Art, and believe me, I spent endless hours wrestling with this, and the answer for you and for your audience is, be careful what you ask for, because you will get it. So
that's not really comforting, Charles.
Well, I'm not suggesting we should, hook up the entire world's computer systems to a kind of a weapons-based solution for problems.
Well, if you've got life, buddy, they may hook themselves up. They may make a decision that says, look, to achieve what I've been given as a goal, I'm going to need control of certain networks.
Dating back to the Forbin Project, this film that came out back in the 60s.
Thank you.
I know the whole story. Silicon-based life forms.
I know, but you don't. Your only answer is be careful what you ask for.
Yes, and I mean that not facetiously. I would say ask for things in very small increments and measure how those answers were made on an incremental basis. I think where people go wrong is they want the whole enchilada all at once, and they go for these grandiose solutions.
Oh.
Yeah, the EC will come up with some bizarre answers because it'll find the most logical path.
All right, if you have a website, plug it real quick because we're out of time.
That's okay. historianofthefuture.com, that's my website. And a project that I'm really fond of because I'm on their board, I think it's a great project. It's called greensavvy.net. Those are the two websites, and then the third would be fourthventure.com.